Okay, thank you for coming back. My name is Lehan Tan. I'm working in Hong Kong. I'm a physicist. I'd like to begin by thanking Michael and Luca for making this short visit possible, and also for arranging this progress report. This past week, I've been here for a few days, and I'm very happy to meet a lot of old friends, but also making some new ones. I've learned a lot from these talks, and also, I mean, the way the discussion is going really remind me of all the good days in physics, you know, really get to the issues and grill the speaker and things like that. When it really, we need this kind of intensity to get somewhere. There've been a lot of talks on these evolution models, fitness landscape and so on, which I don't understand so well. But I think the physiology aspect of these organisms obviously can play a big role in these fitness discussions. We know that any organism in nature is a very complex object. So I think a lot of the study is actually trying to really understand this complexity, how we can describe it. I think until we know that, then these models, it's hard to really know, you know, whether they really capture the essence of the problem. That's at least one thing I got out from the discussions. I'm no expert on evolution. I think at least in some of the cases, the fitness actually related to the growth rate of the organism. And if you think about what determines the growth, actually, I can think it may include at least two components. One is the efficient usage of the resources in the environment. But efficiency doesn't always translate to fast growth. You know, you can have, like in Europe, people being very environmental friendly and so on, but not necessarily going at the fastest speed. But also there's another speed which may be determined by another set of things. So in fact, from a computational point of view, there is a established framework for at least define the optimal efficiency one can achieve for a given organism. If you know the whole genome, the possible enzymes that can be in a cell, then using this method, you can at least compute the optimal efficiency of the system. It's called flux analysis. It's actually quite well-known method. But most of the work I'm going to report to you is trying to go beyond this flux balance analysis. In fact, the way you achieve, you try to compute this optimal efficiency is using a mathematical technique called linear programming. And it's actually something too fancy for a real cell to do the that kind of mathematics. So in reality, what's happening is really you try to control the flux, the way you partition your nutrient into the synthesis of different biomass components through various levels of regulation, in particular at the branch points of the metabolic flow. So actually most of the focus today is trying to first of all understand these degrees of freedom that you have that need to be regulated in order to achieve this optimal solution or near optimal solution, and also look at some real data to see how this regulation is actually done in the case of E. coli. And then this discussion of speed, which actually I will not say too much about, but if there's time in the end, I will mention a little bit of some recent work by Terry Hua and his collaborators. In fact, Terry will be here maybe in a week, right? So he can tell you more about what they have done recently. I think the main message from their work is that the actual composition, like say protein composition in a cell, actually is very much growth rate dependent. Okay, so the cell actually adjusts its internal, a lot of the regulation actually is related to how fast you need to grow, how you partition the resources and so on. So these kind of issues is completely ignored in the FBA, but it's necessary if you want to really understand the things that control the actual growth rate of a given organism. Of course, the ultimate dream is hopefully to be able to really expand the kind of physiology we observe of the real cell. For example, can you someday have a theory that actually explain why E. coli, the fastest rate of growth will be like a 20-30 minutes, a doubling time, okay? So at the moment, the way I see it, there's really no even a framework to address this kind of issue. Okay, yes?
So, I mean, maybe you're gonna get to this, or maybe it's just beside the point, but I don't know a lot about flux balance analysis, but I don't understand how it can completely sort of ignore these things that are in the papers of Terry Waskow, because I mean, producing proteins like biribosomes, that's not one of the fluxes that are in the flux balance analysis models?
Well, in a way it is. It is there, but in that analysis, there's nothing that tells you about the actual speed. I mean, it just tells you if you want to make most efficient use of your nutrient, how you should partition your flux.
In fact, the flux balance analysis uses what Terry studies as an input, right? It takes as an input what is the composition of a bacterium.
That's,
in terms of
actually just look at the dry mass of the cell
blocks and then tries to optimize it. And since it uses it as an input, it can never predict it. It can only verify it, sort of.
So in flux balance analysis, they don't solve for a situation where all the components are growing exponentially at the same rate. Because I would think that would be the thing you have to solve, no?
No, that is what they solve. I mean, they look at like steady state growth situation.
At a given percentage rate, it has to be certain.
No, you have to fix basically what they define so-called objective function, right? So this is a biomass formula. And then they say, okay, given you have this set of enzymes, what's the most efficient way, which means most efficient usage of your nutrient so that the least amount goes to the waste and the most amount goes into the useful stuff. That's what the calculation is doing. But it doesn't give you anything else.
Can I add another comment that the flux balance analysis assumes that the metabolic network is kind of God-given, so that it is what it is,
right,
and then tries to optimize the growth to the best, you know, ignoring regulation, saying that regulation will fine-tune to whatever the flux is.
Has been fine-tuned, yeah.
But then there is another set of questions. I don't know if you go to touch on them in your talk later on. If you just want to synthesize a certain number of final products, what is the most efficient metabolic network to do it? And there are groups which work on this topic that's asking how optimal is the metabolism.
You mean allow the organism to assemble this enzyme?
Yeah, in a way, if you have multiple pathways to produce the same product, which one would be it?
You can start with your master metabolic network. That's, you include all the possible enzymes that we know in the world, and then you try to optimize.
But I mean, so it's just that I find this all very extremely interesting. So I would, in flux balances, if there's a flux that says take loose amino acids and string them together into proteins,
right,
and you want to have everything balanced, and flux balance analysis says the enzymes that do that are ribosomes, then shouldn't flux balance analysis also tells you that the fraction of ribosomes has to go up as you go faster?
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's something.
I don't understand why that is not in there. I mean, how can it be balanced if that's not in there? This is something what I don't get.
No, it does what you tell it to do, right? That's like what Sergei said. But you have to define the objective function. Okay, and this objective function may depend on the growth rate, even though I'm not too sure. I mean,
But I think ribosomes are not part of this, because they just say that if you produce sufficient amount of all the basic amino acids and DNA and RNA bases in right proportion, then somehow it will all be fine, right? So the ribosomes will adjust, but they do not increase.
So that is
the ribosomes. So the enzymes are not modeled.
No,
it's not in the model. It's
you need to make it run so fast that to get a certain flux of producing certain reactions, they don't model that you now need gazillion enzymes for this.
Enzyme is not in the but in the accounting, yeah, right.
Just but they just in there that you have it, and that's why you can have the reaction.
But they don't model the fact that
it's just an on-off, basically.
Right, but they don't model the fact that you need as you go faster, you need more of it. And that's also a cost.
Yeah, no,
that they don't model. All right.
Yeah, it can be actually more complex than that. But anyway, Terry will be here next week asking for these details. Okay, so of course, and for the growth issue, it's supported by a very complex metabolic network, and that you can represent this network in different ways. Some are maybe more useful than others. This is a representation that people in a complex network community like. So basically, they just collect all possible reactions in a given organism, and then make a plot like this. So in this diagram, there are two kinds of nodes. The green represent the compound node, and the red represent the reaction node. So they form this gigantic, really messy network, and then they, of course, you can count how many reactions a given compound participate, and some compounds participate in many reactions, and some only a few. So you can then make a plot, some statistics, make the plot of this degree, and see power laws, things like that. But you don't learn much about the really biology behind this network. And then there is this diagram that used by biochemists, and it's really like a very complex circuit diagram. You see the glycolysis pathway, TCA, somewhere here, and then branch into these pathways that are leading to all kinds of these biomass components, amino acids, nucleotides, and so on. It's very complicated. But you can also take a somewhat more like a physicist point of view, try to highlight the backbone structure of this network, which basically looks like a so-called bow tie. So you have these pathways that connect the different possible usable carbon sources that can be used by the organism. So this is the fan-in part of this system. And then you need to synthesize these different kind of end products. So in fact, in terms of the topology, it's more like if you ignore some of these other compounds, that and mostly the purpose is to assist the reactions or providing little pieces. If you're mostly focusing on the carbon flow or the skeleton of these compounds, then you see a much simpler network like this. But then you can argue that there may be some arbitrariness the way people come to this kind of diagram. So one thing we did was to see whether there's some kind of a systematic method that allow you to start from this kind of a messy diagram and come to something that's a lot more illuminating in some ways.
Let me just make sure, what are the kind of approximations when you go from the blue hairball to this perfectly linear tree?
Mm-hmm.
With
that's something I'm going to tell you in a few minutes. Okay. Now, of course, this is just the kind of like a road for the traffic. So you can think of the metabolism as some kind of a traffic flow of compounds, the mass flow from the nutrient down to these basic units for the macromolecules. But behind it is also another very complex set of regulatory interactions that control this flow. And then there are many huge databases where you can learn about these kind of regulatory interactions. I just listed the major ones here. And then, of course, the metabolic system has been studied for at least half a century, and there's really a lot of knowledge about this. So in a way, it's a very nice system for us to study because people know so much. But then if you really want to go to Ray, especially trying to understand what's going on, still maybe the knowledge is not sufficient. So this picture I stole from John Doyle's talk, trying to make analogy between bacterial cell and like a car. So I think this is kind of the nice analogy one should have in mind, trying to understand this system. It's really like a very complex machine. And also through evolution, as we heard many talks, many of the components have really been optimized. So when you ask the question whether you're asking something at the very local level, like a wheel or small components, or like or you trying to understand the basic structure or the basic mechanism, how the car moves forward and so on. So the discussion today is going to be on some not on the details, fine refinements, but mostly on the basic mechanism of regulation that basically make the car relatively efficient. Of course, in this database, there are really so many different interactions. It's really, I think it's going to take a long time before we understand why a particular one is there, what is the purpose of having that, and so on. Okay, so as I mentioned, that this optimal performance of this system can be computed using this flux balance analysis, and the way the computation is done is actually very simple. You consider kind of a steady state growth for the cell, where inside the cell, any particular metabolite, the concentration will not increase or decrease. You're in a steady state. So the fluxes that of the reactions that produce the compound should balance the flux of the reactions that consume that particular compound. So we have a set of equations like this for all the intermediate compounds in this flow. Okay, and then you feed the system with some nutrient, and then you need to provide some other elemental compounds to make the system work, and then you can study the problem under different kind of environmental conditions, with oxygen, without oxygen, and so on. And then at the end of this system, you you want to harvest a bunch of these chemicals known as the biomass components. These are mostly these basic units for the macromolecules in specified proportions. Okay, so this proportion can depend on, of course, it can depend on the organism, say E. coli or yeast. These numbers can be slightly different, or even can be made to be growth rate dependent for a given organism, but maybe a different kind of growth rate, the composition can be slightly different. Okay, but in fact, some of these, for example, the carbon in the nutrient also goes into the waste. It's kind of necessary because the carbon source is used not only for producing these compounds, but also generate the energy. And then, so in the end, there will be some low energy molecules that are coming out. That's also taken care of in this model. And as I said, that the way the calculation is done to find the optimal, so for a given amount of nutrient, okay, what's the most amount of this biomass you can produce from this system? And this can be computed using a linear programming techniques, because these kind of equations, these are really like linear constraints on your variables. So in this approach, the variables are the fluxes instead of concentrations of the compounds. And then you're just trying to maximize the flux that going into the biomass, and with this set of linear constraints. This biomass also is a linear function of the fluxes for all these components in a particular combination. Okay, so this is a standard linear programming problem, which can be solved actually fairly easily, and the result gives you the upper limit on the it's not really the growth speed. I think it's really how much biomass you can produce for given flux of the nutrient.
I'm trying to understand. So this is a solution where the biomass is growing linearly?
Biomass, you have a rate. Yeah, I mean, linearly means if you allow the nutrient to come in at a fixed rate, okay? Nutrient coming at a fixed rate, then a certain percentage of that will go into the biomass. That's all what this is doing. Of course, in the real cell, if you have more cells, right, each cell will grow at a certain rate, and then of course it will divide, and if you have more cells, then...
Yeah, but it's even the case that inside each cell, it grows exponentially, right? I mean, this is the thing where I really don't understand this theory, right? Everything has to go up exponentially, not linearly.
Why do you say in a given cell?
Yeah, it's related to the concentration.
The concentration stays constant, because the volume grows exponentially, and the number...
But you can outgrow your source.
Yeah. No, I mean the cell, each cell grows.
I know.
What do you mean grow linear?
The total amount of stuff is still growing exponentially.
Yeah, because you have more and more cells. The number of cells grow exponentially.
It's a pure cell.
But the cell itself doesn't grow. Yeah, it does. The cell does grow exponentially.
Each individual cell.
No.
Yes. It does. And then it splits.
It does matter because the time is not the issue here. It's the relative concentration. The way to think about all those numbers are relative weights of those compounds in the biomass. I just don't know what kind of normalization is used in this table. Why?
No, it's everything linear.
Like 23, whereas biomass is 1.
This number just means how many molecules of each you need to make 1 unit of this biomass.
Yeah. And those are empirically determined.
Yeah, right.
Those are somebody kind of, measured, not exactly, but guesstimated.
It's really just how to partition your flux in a way that most of it goes into the biomass. That's all what this calculation is doing. And then you can, of course, relate it to this exponential growth, how the That should be a simple argument, but it's not. This calculation is just doing what I said. Okay.
But exactly, making 1 unit of biomass, what does it mean? I just tried to think about it. What does it mean that I need 0.46 elements to make one biomass? What is biomass is 1 gram of
This just it's the unit.
It's a unit.
It's just some. It's nothing complicated, but you can figure it out. But it's not really the point here.
So it's only relative things are better here, not that.
Right.
If I multiply everything by constant factor, it would be the same.
Right, you just measure the biomass in a different unit. Okay, so here, of course, in order to understand what's really going on, you have to know that how this the flux splitting or distribution is actually determined in a real cell, and also the cell doesn't always follow this particular way of splitting the flux. In fact, there are examples, if you look at the real data. Actually, there are many cases where this the result you get from this flux balance analysis agree quite well with the experiment, but there are also cases where you don't find agreement. And for maybe reasons, for other reasons. It's not always maybe if optimizing the biomass production is not always what the cell wants to do. So we really need to understand how in reality, how this flux splitting is regulated. And in fact, in order to answer that question, first we need to find these decision points, okay, where you can actually, there is some freedom for other possible solutions in this flow. And also, suppose you can identify this set of degrees of freedom or the decision points, then how to you regulate so that the flux pattern will, at least in some cases, follow the one that's determined by the flux balance analysis. In fact, if you look at the real data, then there are actually three levels of regulation. One is, of course, gene expression control, and this can be used to eliminate futile cycles, the pathways that you don't need in the synthesis. And this, the time scale for this kind of change of the gene expression pattern is on the order of minutes. But there's also a mechanism for fast regulation through the small molecules, allosteric regulation. And then there's a third level of regulation. It's a management of the more global resources like ATP-ADP ratios and redox potential, things like that. Okay, so there you can roughly divide the regulatory interactions into these three categories. And we hope that, first of all, we need to demonstrate, you know, what if you use these three tools to manipulate the system, you can achieve this optimal flow. And then, of course, there can be even finer improvements on this basic scheme for reasons, for example, at the concentration of a particular compound. If it's too high, then it can be toxic for the cell, or because the cell very often encounters situations where you have to do adjustments, then there can be some optimal concentration levels that will help improve the fitness of the organism under these situations. And of course, there's so many things that can happen. But if you have a basic scheme, then you can kind of iterate on it.
So of these three things, the first two seem to me things of how you regulate.
Mm-hmm.
The third one more what you regulate. So I could imagine that homeostasis of global commodities involves both small molecule regulation and transcription regulation.
Yeah, that's pretty true. Yeah, I mean the concentrations.
So they're not like disjoint sets of things, right?
But this more global things, because they kind of is relevant for many different reactions. So there's usually a dedicated system to take care of that homeostasis. But for a particular, say, compound, usually also you are right that the concentration in the cell, it doesn't fluctuate. Sometimes it fluctuates quite a bit. But I think for these more global commodities, their fluctuations ranges can be much smaller than a particular metabolite. Yeah, but the you are right that many, I don't know, I mean there's more and more measurements these days about the metabolite concentrations. And it can be a growth condition dependent, but they for given growth condition, then probably it will also be fixed in a relatively small range. And it's actually interesting to see. I'll give you some examples. There may be the reasons for that to happen, and also mechanisms for that to happen. So the first thing is to identify these decision points. In fact, that's not too difficult. So introduce the scheme. So maybe it's not too interesting for this group. So I just tell you, you can start with this very messy network. And the reason why it's messy is because you include all compounds in the system. In fact, if you look at the compounds which have a high degree, that's highly connected, used in participating in many, many different reactions, these are compounds which really do not define the metabolic flow, but rather they are just, for example, in this particular reaction in the purine synthesis pathway, I think, then you need at some stage to, for example, in this particular case, you may use adenosine as the, as maybe the nitrogen source, you know, this deamination reaction. But the real flow is like from at dosing this compound to this other compound. But in the network, if you plot all the compounds in the system, then you'll see also these kind of nodes. And many reactions, this deamination reaction is quite common, and they all have this ammonia component. So it makes the network very, very messy. But they don't really define the flow. So if you remove this kind of compounds in the reaction formula, then you can simplify the network and then really expose the part that corresponds to the carbon flow in the system. And in fact, you can make a systematic study of this, how many reactions each compound participate, and make a list, and then also group them according to their chemical properties. Like this group, they are not participating in the carbon flow, and these are just small components. And then also a few that contain carbon, but these are really just fragments. So if you remove these kind of compounds, and also there are compounds which participate in the reaction as a carrier, they just donate a particular chemical group. You can also make a list of these and remove them because they have their function in these reactions is fairly well defined, and they don't really define the flow, metabolic flow in the system. So you can remove also these group of compounds. And then after you have done that, then you come to a much simpler network. Okay, so that's one thing you do. For example, you start with, this is a branch coming off from the glycolysis and leading to the production of these two particular amino acids. So after you have done a removal, then, and also you have linear pathways, you can also, if you're just interested in how the flow takes place, you can also shrink the linear pathways. And after the removal and the shrinking, then you come to a much simpler network with a much simpler topology.
But in the end, this is done by hand. I mean, you just pick by hand which things you
want. Well, what we did was, okay, so this list you can easily produce. It's just doing the sorting and so on. And then you can, of course, also check the chemical formula by the computer. I mean, that's just very easy. And of course, you, in the end, you want to use a little bit of your biochemistry knowledge to make sure that the things you remove really make sense. It's a little bit of...
For somebody that has zero, like me, biochemistry knowledge.
Right. You do doing pretty well, yeah. You don't...
How would you know? I mean, so there is no... You couldn't write down an algorithm that says, if this and that, right, remove it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go in the end by hand to say, well, actually, this one I don't want to remove.
I would say 95% of the work is done automatically.
Maybe by degree, more or less. The frequency is the same as degree, how many reactions it participates in.
Okay, so here I'm going to show you an example, like taking this in silico model constructed by Parsons group for E. coli. It's called, they now have two, the earlier version, IJR904, and the more recent version, which also includes some regulatory interactions in order to get better agreement with the experimental data. Okay, so the example I will show you just from this earlier example, IJR904. So after you start with this, if you put all possible compounds in this set of reactions in the plot, then you get this thing. And then after the removal, then you get something which really very much look like what the biochemists know, or the way they think about this metabolic system with fairly obvious community structures. So it's this is TCA cycle, glycolysis. This part is for these different kind of sugars coming. This is fan-in part, basically, into this central metabolism. And then there are these branches into these are nucleotides. And I think here there are these different amino acids. Okay, so you see a fairly clear topology that corresponds to what you learn in biochemistry.
What are the blue and black lights?
I think the blue is a reversible, supposed to be reversible reactions. Yeah.
But it's still, you know, not linear pathways because you still have quite a few.
Yeah, there's loops.
Loops and also reactions which involve multiple substrates.
That's true. That's true.
Even you take A plus B, even after you get rid of all of those.
That's why you have this kind of links, yeah. Otherwise, it will be like completely two-dimensional, I guess. Yeah. So, but it's already, you know, you see clear communities, and you see mostly some kind of trees-like structure, but you see some loops, and loops are actually, of course, needed because we heard about growth on the LB, and then amino acid, particular amino acid, can be synthesized by the system de novo, but also can be used. So there's some kind of forward-backward pathways. Okay, of course, this kind of loops in a real cell, then you don't want the loop to be operating because that way you generate some futile cycle that just consumes your resources without producing anything useful.
What's so, of that your diamond shape versus triangular or round?
Okay, so sorry. So these guys are actually the biomass components, the diamonds. These are and these rare ones are the amino acids. I think here the nucleotides, and then the squares are the reaction nodes and the compounds. So these different color scheme are the different communities. You can identify using some standard community detection algorithm.
So for instance, three that is sitting there by itself.
Yeah, well, there's something I think not, it shouldn't happen. Oh. I think there's a remove maybe too many. There's some node that should not be removed, yeah. Okay, but we are still cleaning up. That's why I say the work in progress is almost done, but.
Also, it's the light-reaching part of the metabolism is kind of considered to be happening in parallel to this, right? So any reaction which involves some nitrogen-carrying compounds,
mm-hmm.
you assume that the nitrogen-carrying compounds are provided by this other subnetwork because this is only on...
Yeah, this is mostly focusing on carbon. That's correct, yeah. So now, if you have this diagram, and then if you look at a particular flux pattern, like the one identified by FBA with like growth on glucose, then you see that actually not all the, of course, these kind of reactions are on, and many of them are off. And then you see a structure which is even more tree-like, and the loops become open. Okay, so suppose this is your kind of a target flow pattern. Okay, you start with this network, and then you want to put in the regulations so that you will generate a flux pattern which is like this. So the question is how you can do it. And then...
sorry, Leha, what are the orange circles here?
These are the amino acids, okay.
I see.
This is like a terminal.
But the flux, what should we look here at? The thickness of arrows, which is what you get from the flux balance analysis?
That's correct, yeah. And only the reactions which carry a non-zero flux are shown in this diagram. So in order to, say, starting from such a network, and then for given a growth condition input, say glucose, and then you want to produce a flux pattern like this. Okay, so how do you regulate it? But the regulation actually, there are two levels. One is that you need to turn off a set of reactions, but also there are these branch points where the flux at the branch point will take, for example, here, it can, this this y is a is an amino acid. That's it. Not really very well. Okay, so this is supposed to be one of these end products, but also it's an intermediate compound in a pathway. Okay, so that branch points where to reach this optimal solution, you need to control the branch ratio. So you can do, for example, in order to reach this solution, so you can try to go through this network and identify these branch points and count what are the degrees of freedom that need to be regulated. If you have like the complete network, then there are these, you can divide these degrees of freedom into assign them to the branch points and also these loops, because loop, if it can run on its own, then also they correspond to a degree of freedom that need to be regulated. So this can be done fairly easily. Basically, if you look at this network, then there are these compounds which can be used to synthesize different products. Okay, so this is the branching situation. Then, so each of these cases, then you can count depending how many branches, then this increase the number of degrees of freedom. And then there are also some other reaction, as you noticed previously, that use multiple substrates. So in that case, the flux need to, because of this stoichiometry, the flux need to be in a certain ratio. So this puts a constraint on this variable. So that reduces the number of degrees of freedom. And then you can go through all these compound nodes in the system and do your to count the final number of degrees of freedom. In fact, because you have this mass conservation, then for this particular model, the actual degrees of freedom is something like 300, and this includes 124 transport reactions that bring the stuff into the system. That's the very general case. If all the reactions are on, then you have still this many variables. Now, in reality, the way you produce this particular flux pattern is to go through these first two levels of regulation, which I mentioned earlier. So here I take an example of the synthesis of the amino acids. You can cut out a sub-network of this whole metabolic network, focusing on these 20 different amino acids. And then you get a diagram like this one. So these amino acids, they are shown with this box around them. And so for most of the amino acids, you see there are pathways that are leading to their synthesis, but they can also be used as a nutrient or carbon source, and feedback into the central pool. These kind of back routes are shown by the dashed lines. So if you say you are considering a case where the glucose is the only carbon source, then in the real flux pattern, then these dashed lines should be, these kind of pathways should be turned off. And this is actually done by at the transcriptional level. And if you look at the data, for example, from this work, then you see that indeed all these backward pathways, they are downregulated when the system is grow in the glucose minimum medium as compared to a rich medium. But there are more detailed information. I don't have really time to go through it until, I mean, if you are interested, then we can discuss about these numbers later. So this way, through the transcriptional regulation, you can kind of reshape the network so that only the pathways that you need will be on. these other pathways that you don't need, you are not supposed to use in order to be in this optimal flow pattern, they can be turned off through the transcriptional regulation. But there's still the question of the flux partitioning. For example, from here, then this compound can be used to produce these products following this pathway, but it can also go down along the glycolysis pathway. Okay. So what
this partitioning would then depend on regulation?
Yeah, it should be regulated. So if you want to be in this optimal mode, then this ratio should be at a particular value. So in this particular case, in fact, the way the cell does it is through a so-called, it's a very well-known mechanism called end product inhibition. So its idea is very simple. So if you are if there's too much flux going down a particular pathway, that will lead, and then you cannot use it, because in the end, the cell will use these amino acids to synthesize the proteins. So, and these different protein and the amino acids are used in a particular ratio. Okay, so if some amino acids are produced at a higher rate compared to other amino acids, and they are not used, so it will lead to an accumulation of that amino acid. And this, so the concentration will grow, and then there are these so-called end product inhibition mechanisms that will slow down the enzyme that control actually the entry point of this particular pathway. Okay, so the system can automatically adjust itself through this end product inhibition mechanism.
Are all those feedback loops through allosteric regulation taken from the experiment, or?
Yeah, they are all from the literature.
I see.
All from the literature.
Is there a database for this?
Well, there's this huge, it's called ECOSOL.
Uh-huh.
It's actually it evolved from Leichhardt's. This
yeah.
Encyclopedic
right.
volume, right? And then we also did the I think most of these interactions are obtained from there, but then we also search the literature.
Sorry, I don't quite understand how this works. So you have a branch point, and you want the flux to have a certain fraction of it go
right.
this way and a certain fraction of it go that way.
Right.
And you're saying this is done by the fact that the actual products that come out,
mm-hmm.
they stick to the enzymes that produce the products, right?
Right,
and
right.
therefore they inhibit the reuse of
right.
these enzymes.
Exactly.
But doesn't that then sort of lead, I mean, that only constrains the total number of enzymes that's bound, not the relative numbers that bind this product versus that product, no? I just don't understand how that automatically gets the balance of these two right.
Okay, so what the cell needs is to have, okay, so the rate of producing these different amino acids, they need to be in a certain ratio, okay? Now suppose, but this production is following different pathways, right? So if the flux going into a particular pathway, suppose it's higher, okay, then you start to produce more of this, which you don't really use. Okay, so the concentration of that particular compound will go up, right? And then it will, this allosteric regulation is bind part of, it's not the, so that amino acid doesn't participate in this reaction, okay? So, I mean, there are also cases where you can have a self-inhibition. You can inhibit the immediate reaction, the enzyme that actually produces this particular compound. But there are also many of these cases is somewhere upstream. You bind a particular part of that enzyme to make it less efficient or completely disable its ability to catalyze that reaction.
You actually see, this is a good example, you see how this branching point works, because the end products, the two end products up there, they do not regulate the same enzyme, they regulate two different enzymes. So one is controlling the branching ratio, and the other is controlling the overall flux from 3PG to Serum.
I mean, I'm just trying to understand how robust sort of this measure. So, if you now change, let's say the actual constants by how much a certain concentration of one enzyme inhibits of one product inhibits the other enzyme, the ratios of steady state concentration you get out will be the same, or they actually totally depend on those.
Well, I think this M-port inhibition mechanism, if you have a treat kind of a network, okay, because this backward pass already is taken care of by the gene regulation, okay. So suppose you have this kind of a treat network to work with, and then you need to ensure that the different branches at the end, they are these compounds at the end of this tree, these leaves, they are produced at the same certain proportion. Okay, so if a particular branch, the flux going to that branch is not in the right proportion, then it will lead to an accumulation, for example, of that end product. So that end product, if there's a feedback mechanism, then automatically it will prevent, it will self-adjust the flux into that branch.
Okay, so I understand. All right. So I understand there is a steady state,
mm-hmm.
and there is negative feedback that pushes you back to the steady state.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
But if I change, let's say, if I make a mutation to one of these guys, and now the amount of inhibition that glycine puts on this enzyme that makes serine becomes a bit different,
right.
you're going to change your steady state, no?
No, it will change. Okay, so. If it's less, as long as each branch has this feedback, right? The strength actually is not important, but you need to have the feedback. As long as you have the feedback, then it's okay.
So I think it's a steady state should change because ultimately the binding constant of the small molecule on this pocket in the enzyme which is responsible for allosteric regulation should determine the kind of final concentration at some level, right?
Right.
So when the final concentration is too low, it doesn't bind enough. When it raises above a certain threshold, it starts binding efficiently, right? So the K dissociation constant, Kd, for this would determine the final concentration. And if you make a mutation which will affect this Kd, you should affect the final concentration. For instance, if you completely
disable
this.
That's correct, yeah. The concentration will change, but the flux doesn't need to change. Mm-hmm. Depends. The flux depends on how fast these end products are used in the pooling synthesis.
That may be actually true. Conservation will change, but the flux is, the flux will just make sure that you accumulate enough of this end product to finally bind. Unless you completely disable it
altogether,
right? Okay.
Okay. So basically, this feedback mechanism can take care of the getting the right branching ratios for this fluxing to these different pathways. And then there's actually some recent data we looked at on the concentration of. A number of these compounds in the E. coli, and they actually measured about 100 such compounds, and some of these are in this diagram. So we compare this measured metabolite concentration with the Ki. Ki is the parameter that's in the defines above a certain concentration, then this feedback interaction will be turned on, okay, for a particular.
It is a binding constant, which I was talking about.
It's, so you can say that, yeah. So basically, this, it's just the standard kind of Michaelis-Menten kind of equation. So if you have a concentration that exceeds this Ki, then basically you have a you have a strong suppression of the enzyme activity.
I'm sorry, but I really want to understand this, and I realize I still don't understand this. So the argument that you said is, well, in steady state, by definition, the fluxes have to be balanced. So if you change these two mutations, you may change the concentrations of things, but the fluxes will be balanced. Right. But the whole point is, there's more than one solution in which all the fluxes are balanced, right? There are different solutions. There are solutions where at each branching, there's going more this way or less that way, right? Or is there only one solution in which
the fluxes are balanced? You have a tree structure, and then you require the way these input are used, then it's only one solution. Yeah.
So that's the key then, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a tree,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then there's only really one solution that balances all the
things. Right, right, that's correct.
That's actually very important, yes. Okay, great, thanks.
So you get a tree because of the gene expression regulation. Because originally there are these loops backwards, so you don't have a tree, but then if the transcriptional regulation can take care of that, then you get a tree. And then
the fundamental argument is any loop cannot be efficient because you're doing something in a loop.
Right.
So in your optimal state, you're a tree, and when you're a tree,
yeah,
then there's only one solution.
Yeah. You need the feedback. So that you will be in a steady state. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and this plot here just show that actually this kind of feedback mechanism is actually in operation, in particular growth conditions. They feed the bacteria with three different carbon source, and then this correspond to these three different symbols, and we compare the measured metabolite concentration with the Ki value. They all seem to lie within all the magnitude.
Upward,
yeah, from this curve.
Those are two completely independent measurements, right? The metabolite concentration comes from this 2009 paper, and Ki comes from some earlier wet lab. In vitro experiments. Is Ki measured in vitro or
Ki, I think, is in vitro. We got it from the Brenner
database. That is actually remarkable that you get this within one order of magnitude of each other, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can I come back to the tree? I don't understand. If you have a metabolite which is produced by one reaction and mm-hmm. consumed by two others,
right?
Why can't you divide arbitrarily fluxes on the tree? So what's
You can in principle, but it really depends. So this downstream, the usage reactions, you say, okay, so this metabolite can go into two different pathways, right? So there are two different enzymes that can use this as substrate. And then you want to know whether what controls the ratio, how much of that going to this pathway and how much going to that pathway. And that's determined not at this level, but at the downstream of these two pathways.
The very endpoint, right, the one which goes to biomass. So those glycine and this. So all those endpoints go into biomass in fractions prescribed by the flux balance.
For example, this guy.
The regulation going back somehow has a similar effect to biomass production, biomass maximization.
So FBA, basically, the reason why you get optimal is to, if you can eliminate all these futile cycles and also minimize the amount of carbon that goes into the waste, like carbon dioxide. Okay, that's basically what you need to do to reach this optimal usage of your nutrient.
You think those red feedback loops are not needed for FBA? MBA doesn't have any predictions about the metabolite absolute concentrations, only about fluxes.
That's correct.
So the role of those feedback loops is to make sure that the some fluctuations or that the steady state concentrations of end products will not go out of the usual population. Because ultimately there is one flux of each of those end products into biomass. So they are not being really end products, they are being consumed to build new biomass. And if something slows down for some reason, then you can you want to shut down your conveyor belt.
I guess the question that comes to Martin's question again is, I understand if the relative fluxes with which your end products are taken out, so your amino acids and nucleotide, that are taken out, if those are set somehow, then you will get to that steady state that produces that.
Yeah,
I understand that. But then the question is, what sets that really? Right?
Well, that's so the usage
that really
part.
Sets, you know, if I express different proteins, then the amount of leucines that I need versus valines may change, right? So that is still, there's not really clear.
That's why you need those feedback loops, because then you kind of a little bit adjust your conveyor belt speeds. If everything goes as planned, you don't even need to regulate those red feedback loops. But if there is some, you know, variability.
If you don't have this feedback, then it may be some compound that would will be overproduced and accumulate, and that will not be good.
And you cannot regulate the transcription because it's too slow. The transcription regulation takes forever. This one happens very fast.
Yeah.
But also in principle, I guess along the same lines that your products which you have, whatever, cysteine and glycine, their usage sort of depends on their own concentrations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you sort of keep adjusting your concentration to make the same amount of flow, somewhere it's going to break because there's only so much.
It will force some other,
The downstream is also sort of starting to get sort of realized that it's too much of glycine, so you start helping more. So it's not clear that the.
No, at the moment we are not, it's not a full model, it's just a kind of a schematic thing, how you can. Have staying in steady state by having this kind of feedbacks. And this feedback seems to be really in operation under this, at least in these experiments.
What are the sinks actually in this model?
Hmm?
What are the sinks? Where do the sinks that are being produced disappear in the end?
Well, in the end, they are just used for synthesized proteins.
All right, but I mean, what then sets that? What sets the relative fluxes that you are putting asparagine versus cysteine?
Well, that's this your consumption part, right?
I guess your whatever genome composition.
That depends on which mRNAs are expressed.
Absolutely,
right.
Absolutely. That's why it's not completely fixed.
I think it's given by some typical. There's one condition in the composition.
But then if we say, let's say there are also some things that go in the membrane, right?
Yeah.
Certain lipids that go in the membrane versus amino acids.
Which is determined by the size of the bug, for instance.
Right, that's determined by, how big is the bug?
That's not what the metabolic system need to worry about, right?
Well, you do need to worry about, because what stops you from, let's say, you go into a steady state where, you're producing twice as many lipids relative to amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
And you're accumulating all these lipids that you don't know what to do with, right?
Yeah, no, but
and then the red loop kicks in. Red loop doesn't let you produce too much. If your lipid concentration went above the level where they start inhibiting their own production, the enzyme which produces lipids will just slow down.
Yeah, that's the argument. Yeah, right. So there probably some. So, but that's the requirement on the concentration, right?
Yeah.
If you, if you have.
They know how much.
And what concentration
need
to feedback?
To slow down more or less. So.
I don't want to keep you. From
I don't want to keep you here from lunch. But anyway, so basically, I think so far we have, if you only worry about. This flux issue, how you can reach this optimal flux partitioning predicted by FDA, then there are these two levels of regulation that can do it. Okay, but of course the real cell is more complex, they worry about a lot of other things, and so you need to also invoke this other mechanism, also exactly which concentration is the optimal one, because if the concentrations are wrong, then it may produce some effects like too much membrane instead of proteins and things like that. So, but this is something we have not looked at so far. So, and then for these other, like the compounds which we didn't study in this work where we focus on the carbon flow, then there are also these special systems that take care of their ratios or concentrations, and there's extensive literature also on these. Okay, so this is basically, you know, I just summarized what I talked about. So there's the transcriptional regulation to eliminate the futile cycles. And in fact, according to Terry Wah, he's been talking to many biochemists and microbiology people, they say that actually this gene regulation can already do a very good job, not just in terms of eliminating the unused pathways, but also like even the used enzymes, you know, keep the enzyme copy number to be within 10% of what you need. But I don't really know, but he said it's kind of a common knowledge in that field that people think that the gene expression can really do a good job. And so he thinks that you don't even need a small molecule regulation in the normal situation, but you need that when you are going from one kind of growth situation to another, say growth medium, this to take care of the transient accumulation of compounds which can be a problem for the cell. But what we see from this data, 2009 data, that actually you see this small molecule regulation is in action. Even in the steady state growth. Okay, then you need this homeostasis of global commodities to manage this other resource you need. I think maybe because it's kind of close to lunchtime, and so this part, beyond the FDA, then there are this whole bunch of other questions, like this 30-minute growth, whether it's in fact almost for any organism, the doubling time of the cells is highly faster than 30 minutes. You get some organism that can do it in 20 minutes, but really not much less than that. What would be the physical limit for the doubling of any cell? And then if there's such a limit, where's the bottleneck? In fact, also there are many other issues related to the physiology of bacteria. For example, in the FDA, actually allow for the usage of multiple carbon source, and that's supposed to speed up the growth, but in reality that doesn't happen. So what? Why it doesn't happen? And also like when you present the bacteria with different kind of sugar in the medium, then there's a kind of order of preference. For example, glucose will be used first before lactose and things like that. And what determines this order of preference? So this may be, in order to answer this kind of questions, you have to do much more detailed accounting, maybe computing the cost for making enzymes and things like that. So there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered. And Terry, as I mentioned, that Terry and his collaborators published a paper recently on which try to, I think, provide a scheme to answer some of the questions. And the idea is very, very simple. So basically, they focus on the relationship or the coupling between the growth rate and the composition of the protein population in a cell. So they have a very kind of a coarse-grained description of what's going on, basically dividing the, you have many, many different proteins, but you can group them into like roughly three categories. There's the ribosomal proteins, and then there's a set of other proteins that are really required for the essential functioning, the growth and the cell division of a bacteria. And then there are a bunch of proteins which are not always essential, but it's nice to have them around. And then what they found was that when the cell grow at different rate, especially when the cell need to grow fast, then these ribosomal proteins that make up the machinery for protein synthesis, that's that part, actually the percentage of this group increases. And they find some linear relationship between the fraction of the ribosomal proteins in the whole protein population against the growth rate. And this, they think, is the bottleneck that sets the how fast a cell can grow. Because if you want to grow faster, then you, in fact, this proportion of the proteins, amino acids that go into the synthesis of ribosomal proteins will increase, but there's a limit. Okay, so and then the ribosomes, they have, each ribosome has a certain speed. You don't have a better machine in the world to synthesize the proteins. And so, of course, if you have more ribosomes, you can do the job faster, but then there's a limit, because you also need, at least you have to synthesize yourself in order to double the cell, but you also need these other proteins in the system to make it work. And then this is basically the idea to explain this, some kind of fundamental limit for cell division. But he will be here in a week, so you can. So there are a lot of, the reason I'm mentioning this is that there are all these data from these databases on the gene, regulation, and so on. So a small fraction of that is related to, for example, eliminating certain pathways under given growth conditions, things like that. But there are also some other regulation. Maybe you need to understand them from some other point of view. So there are, of course, a lot of things going on in order to make a machine that's very efficient. So maybe by combining all these different ideas, eventually you can understand more and more why these kind of regulations are there and things like that. Okay, basically I want to end my talk, and these are the people that these are the students in my group, in particular Yang Zhu. He's the person who did most of the data processing on the metabolic network. The work was done in collaboration with Terry Wah, and a postdoc from Korea. Thank you very much for your attention.